The last time I was in Italy, it occurred to me that few pieces of art actually make a noise. But Michelangelo's art does. As you approach the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican Museum, you hear a commotion. It roars like a rushing river. And then when you step into that chapel, the people are everywhere. The excitement builds. The guards every 5 minutes have to calm the crowds with a big amplified shh. Michelangelo excites people. Michelangelo was a Florentine. He worked in Rome because, well, when the Pope hires you, you can't really turn him down. But Rome was a rough-and-tumble, ramshackle city around the year 1500 when Michelangelo was there. You know, it wasn't a very glorious place at that time for the Vatican to be, but they were stuck there because, you know, upon this rock, St. Peter, I will build my church, and so on. So Peter's tomb was there, the Vatican was there, and the Pope literally bought the artistic dream team to come down from Florence to Rome and help spiff up the city. Getting Michelangelo and all that marble and building that great dome and everything didn't come cheap. They kicked off a fundraising campaign into high gear, spread all the way across Europe. Of course, Martin Luther got wind of that, and here comes the Reformation. It was a heady time, and Michelangelo was really in the center of it. He was right there. He had a huge impact on the Eternal City. Today, we're going to talk about that. I'm joined by Angela Nickerson. She's written a book called A Journey into Michelangelo's Rome. Angela, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, there was my tour guide swing through the heady times 500 years ago in Rome.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Michelangelo's life seemed to just coincide with some really exciting things that were happening, both in terms of the city of Rome itself and then also in Italy. It was this nexus of incredible talent that was arising. And you had the invention of the printing press in 1450. And so there was this promulgation of knowledge and understanding and a great interest in the classics. But then there was also all of this money to be spent. And people decided to spend it on the arts. So all of that together created this amazing environment. It was kind of this amazing stew for artists to live in. And Michelangelo was born just at the right time in the right place.
Yeah. Michelangelo spent years in Rome embellishing the city pretty much for the needs of the church.
In fact, though he always considered Florence his home, he spent more of his life in Rome than he did in Florence. So he really left an imprint on that city.
It was sort of like going to a scuzzy, crummy city, wasn't it? I mean, wasn't all the elegance in Florence and these Florentines like had to wash their hands a lot and try to stay with their friends in Rome because it was not quite as elegant and comfortable of a city?
Well, definitely. Rome had suffered a lot during the Dark Ages. It wasn't the beautiful city that it must have been during the height of the Roman Empire. And it was a city where the Tiber River was just filled with filth, and the streets were filled with human excrement. And it was a dirty, disgusting city in many ways. But the popes knew that in order to hold on to their power, they had been threatened in the 13 and 1400s. At one point, there were several people claiming to be popes. And of course, the papacy had moved to Avignon, France. And so they knew in order to keep the papacy strong in Rome, they were going to have to turn Rome into a first-class city. And so they poured money into the city, into making it beautiful and into making it the kind of city that they envisioned as being appropriate for the seat of Christendom in Europe. You can see that, for example, Julius II decided that he was just going to build some straight streets in the city. And you see Via Giulia, which is very close to the Tiber River. It is the straightest street in Rome because he simply bulldozed a whole bunch of buildings and built a new street that was perfectly straight. It's pretty much the only one in the city. If you walk down Via Giulia, which is a wonderful place to walk, you get an insight into what some of these Renaissance popes longed for within their home city.
Now, this was a time when humanism was running rampant, and there was kind of a struggle between humanism and pre-Christian philosophy and medieval-style Christianity. And, you know, Michelangelo was sort of the cutting edge here. He was an intellect, and they sort of embraced humanism. But was it really at odds with Christianity, or could Christianity in the time of Michelangelo embrace humanism? Talk a little bit about that sort of philosophy slash theology that Michelangelo had to deal with when he was hired to do something for the Pope.
Oh, Michelangelo had to be both a theologian and a philosopher at the same time. And fortunately, he was a very gifted and intelligent thinker. He was greatly read. He had been tutored as a young man by a humanist. He spent much of his life reading and had great friends with whom he would have theological and philosophical discussions. But this wasn't uncommon because the advent of the printing press really brought all of these great works. They made them much more accessible to people. So he had to walk a very delicate line between what he believed philosophically and theologically and what the popes wanted. I kind of think that perhaps had Michelangelo lived somewhere else in Europe at the time, he might have ended up being a Lutheran, because he disagreed with a lot of the things that the popes did. But fundamentally, he knew which side his bread was buttered on, and he knew where his paychecks were coming from. So he had to be very careful about that.
Well, he was decorating the Pope's chapel, the Sistine Chapel, and it was due for a renovation, and the Pope hires Michelangelo to do it, and we get the Sistine Chapel. Let's talk about the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Here we have God giving Adam the spark of life. You know, the famous scene that's in the bottom of fancy swimming pools and so on. And when Michelangelo unveiled that impressive humanistic centerpiece of the Sistine ceiling, did that go over well with the Pope and the Pope's men who paid for this?
It did initially, because, of course, Julius II was the one who commissioned the Sistine Chapel ceiling. And Julius II was as much a humanist in many ways as Michelangelo. They were kind of two peas in a pod. And this great display of human bodies on the ceiling, there were some who disapproved of this, but largely it was enormously popular. It wasn't until after the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation that Michelangelo's penchant for nudity and the glory of the human form fell out of favor. And in his later years, with the Council of Trent and some of the other political maneuverings that were happening, there was a great movement to go in and paint over many of the nudes in the Sistine Chapel. And fortunately, the artists in Rome prevailed upon the powers that be, and they didn't do it until after Michelangelo's death.
Oh, my goodness. That's a beautiful, thoughtful thing, not to let Michelangelo go through that indignity, to have his paintings covered up with little fancy modern loincloths or whatever. Wasn't there a guy actually nicknamed Britches that was hired to paint over all of the penises on the Last Judgment?
Indeed. And he had been one of Michelangelo's assistants.
Oh,
and
man.
He was hired death.
Oh,
I know. It's
how
terrible.
How could he live with himself painting over Michelangelo's beautiful bodies? Hey, I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Michelangelo's Rome with Angela Nickerson, who's written a great book called A Journey into Michelangelo's Rome. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us anytime at radio@ricksteves.com. Jan's on the phone in Mountain House, California. Jan, thanks for your call.
I have a passion for anything Italian, and specifically Michelangelo, and I am curious as to why he relocated from Florence and when he was in the throes of everything and went to Rome.
Well, he was a smart guy and he followed the money. He had great ambitions. Florence started to decline. It had been the center of all art and power. But with Lorenzo de' Medici's death, and his son was not such a great ruler, and Michelangelo could read the writing on the wall, and he knew that a papal commission was the only commission that was going to really keep him financially secure for his life. And so he made his first trip to Rome trying to achieve that papal commission. And he spent the rest of his life kind of balancing back and forth between Florence and Rome, wherever the money actually was. But in the end, he spent more of his life in Rome because that's where more of the money was.
How interesting. Now, was he aware when he went to Rome that the focus of his talent would be on painting rather than sculpturing?
No. He considered himself very much a sculptor. In fact, when he was given the commission to do the Sistine Chapel ceiling, he was not the only person who thought maybe he couldn't do it. Bramante, who was working on the St. Peter's project at the time, said, "Oh, I can't even imagine. Why would you give this project to Michelangelo? He can't possibly do that. He's not a painter." But when the Pope says, "Please paint my ceiling," you have to say, okay.
And Angela, yeah, and Jen, when you look at the Sistine ceiling, when you look at those bodies and the musculature, you see a person whose passion is for sculpting. I mean, he was a sculptor with a paintbrush when you look at his work, I believe.
Oh, absolutely.
He brought them to life, and it's amazing to me that somebody had so much talent. One human being was as gifted as he was, and we can enjoy that now. And it was a great gift to mankind.
Jen, you bring up an interesting point. Angela, give me your take on this. I've always thought when Michelangelo's passion was for sculpting, it kind of fit his faith. He was humble in the presence of God. He was considered himself God's tool. And he thought the most noble art form was not being like a creator, like Leonardo, painting on a blank canvas, creating from nothing, but actually to reveal something that God put into the marble. Michelangelo actually believed that the figure was inside the marble, and what he needed to do was be inspired to chip away the excess and reveal the beauty that God put in that stone. I've heard that from guides in Italy. Does that make any sense to you, Angela?
Oh, yes, definitely. In fact, when you look at the way he sculpted, he didn't sculpt taking a block of marble and working around it. He sculpted from front to back.
Just peeling it away, blowing away the excess.
Literally revealing it.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, how old was he when he did, say, David? What was his first masterpiece? How young was he when he made his first masterpiece?
Well, his first masterpiece was the Pietà.
Okay.
The Rome Pietà, and he was 24 years old.
Now think of a 24-year-old, you know, and give him a big block of marble and a chisel and say, you know, go to work. I mean, David must have been divinely inspired. I mean, it's the only way that a 24-year-old could create that thing.
Absolutely.
He was given God's hand to create, and what a gift it is to all of us.
And I think when we look at David, we see that same sort of theme. I love the notion of looking at David. And when people first looked at Michelangelo's David, they said, well, the hand is too big and too developed. And of course, the theology of David, the boy slaying the giant, was the little boy couldn't slay the giant, but God could slay the giant. And David was acting, with God. And it was actually God that powered that stone. And when we look at that overdeveloped, oversized hand on David, that's the hand of God. And that sort of fit the whole notion that Florence was on God's side and able to rise above its bully, giant, Goliath-type city-state neighbors and succeed. And I just love to psychoanalyze that. And that ties, again, this humanism, where when you look into the eyes of David, you're looking into, you know, medieval man coming out of the darkness and into the Renaissance and sizing up that bully of darkness and entering into a new world where they're much more confident.
But you're also seeing that influence of the classical sculpture, which Michelangelo, especially when he was in Rome, but also in Florence, was able to take time and to study. Because, of course, collecting the art of the ancient Romans became very, very popular during his lifetime. And so he was able to look back and look at those ancient sculptures and model and use them as a touchstone for his own work.
Jen, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
And Shonda's on the phone in Sacramento, California. Shonda.
Yes. I'm curious because I've been to Rome on a brief trip and I've seen Michelangelo's major works. I'm curious about, Angela, what are your favorites of his lesser-known works?
His fingerprints are everywhere. But I have to say, one of the places that I tell people not to miss is Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. It's a little church around the corner from the Pantheon. And in this church is Michelangelo's sculpture, The Risen Christ. It was highly loved at the time, and it is really overlooked now. But it is a figure of Christ nude. At a later point, they added a bronze loincloth over his genitals, but he is coming out of the tomb and emerging, and it is a wonderful piece of art. It's just beautiful.
And it's about 100 yards from the Pantheon, and the Pantheon is just inundated mm-hmm. with tourist crowds. And you step around the corner and you go into Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, one of the few Gothic churches in Rome, and you're all alone with a Michelangelo masterpiece.
Oh,
it's totally true. And it's free.
Another free one is Moses, isn't it, in Peter and James Church?
Absolutely. That is also free. And again,
and
there's
that's a,
no
that's,
line.
And that's 200 yards from the Colosseum. Everybody's packing into
right.
the Colosseum, and they're missing that. Another fun tip would be if you're going to extend your sightseeing hours, you can see the great Michelangelos for free without any crowds in the churches, which open at 7 in the morning, whereas the national sites open at 9 or 10 o'clock. So you can beat those crowds, be in the cool of the early morning, and be all alone with Michelangelo if you know where to go.
Oh,
absolutely.
Nice. Thanks for your call, Shonda.
Thank you.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been speaking with Angela Nickerson. Angela's written a book called A Journey into Michelangelo's Rome. Angela, how did your work on this book enable you to better appreciate the genius of Michelangelo?
You know, I was familiar with all of the iconic images, with the Pietà and the David and the great works of art. But I feel like in doing the research, I got to know the person behind it, too. His religious feelings, his philosophy, the friendships that he had. He was an incredibly loyal friend and employer. And getting to know the trials and tribulations of his life, he just became a much more whole person to me. And certainly he was a genius. But beyond that, there was a man who felt things deeply, who understood things deeply, and who was keenly attuned and really shaped by the world that he was living in at the time.
So if I pull this back to what helps a sightseer appreciate Michelangelo, to properly embrace the art, you really need to embrace the man who made it, and that means understanding the age in which he worked. You're able to
Absolutely.
Understand and appreciate the Renaissance, and then the magic of Michelangelo becomes a highlight of your travels.
Indeed.
Angela Nickerson, thanks for giving us an insight into an artist that the more you know about him, the more you realize it's understandable why he's so many people's favorite.
Thank you so much.
Happy travels.
Rick Steves has spent a third of his adult life in Europe researching and writing guidebooks. His classic, Europe Through the Back Door, teaches the skills of smart travel. Rick Steves' Italy is America's top-selling Italian guidebook. At Rick Steves' online travel store, you'll also find guides for Rome, Venice, Florence, and Tuscany, and Rick's Italian phrasebook. To learn more about Rick's guidebooks for Italy and beyond, visit the travel store at ricksteves.com.